All right, so I'm going to talk to you about stellar rotation, and I'm going to be focusing, kind of in particular, how rotation can be used as a tool. Now, when we talk about rotation, we can kind of think of it in two ways. We can think of it on the side where we know that it has something to do with internal angular momentum transport, has something to do with convection, has something to do with magnetism, and all of those are pretty scary words if you're a stellar astrophysicist. They're all big questions, and they're all things that we don't have answers for. And so, from that point of view, stellar rotation is extremely complicated and very uncertain and something that we don't know everything we'd like to know about. But on the other hand, it has very strong, rotation displays very strong trends as a function of mass, as a function of age, as a function of evolutionary state. And so, we should be able to capitalize on the fact that there are these trends here, regardless of the complications, and actually use it as a tool, not just a problem to be solved. So, to motivate the talk, I like to show this diagram. This is one group's 34,000 rotation period sample. This is not the only group involved in this exercise, but this is the largest sample of rotation periods, and these all come from Kepler. They're spot modulation rotation periods, like Ralph told you about last week. And looking at this diagram, there is a ton of structure here. There's a sharp edge here, there's a sharp edge here. You have, you know, fall off in the density of points, you have a bimodality that's actually here. You should ignore these vertical features. Those are catalog problems. They're not actually real. But there's a lot here, and I'm going to start off by just telling you guys that rotation cares about the age of a star. So somewhere in this diagram, there's information about an age, ages of a population, a distribution of stars. And this could be an incredibly interesting thing to do. But extracting those ages from this diagram is actually more complicated because there's actually a lot going on here. And so the talk today is kind of going to be stepping through the ways that you would take something like this and extract something interesting from it, and how what we're doing to do that, and to validate that what we're doing is correct.
Do you ever notice how much it looks like an eel? Because I mean, you're supposed
to
be like,
it's more,
I don't know,
it's more like
times, but
I think it looks more like a loon.
Yeah.
Like there's the head, there's the eye, the beak. I'd be okay with dolphins. All right, so what we think we know. So this stuff goes back more than 50 years. So this is a paper from 1967 by Robert Kraft, where he looked at a bunch of stars. He measured the rotational velocities of these stars. The indices here are basically setting up an HR diagram for you. The size of the points, it's a color. It's a very narrow band filter is the. Sorry, say it again.
How do you measure the rotation? How did they measure rotation at the time?
It's broadening of the spectral lines.
So it's just a delta rotation.
Yeah. Yep. Which means that, you know, kind of less than 6 kilometers a second, you don't see anything. You pick up the most rapidly rotating things, which is always the problem across the board still today. The big points here, the point size scales with rotational velocity, so the big points are fast, the little points are slow. This is an HR diagram, and he's got tracks plotted on here for different masses. And you see that at about kind of 1.25, you transition actually quite quickly from rapid rotation to slow rotation. And that this is a trend that you see anytime you look at a population of stars that spans these spectral types. Now, if you focus just on the more slowly rotating subset for a second, and you add the information that you get from open clusters, and open clusters give you an age. It's a population of stars. You can use the population to get a better idea of how old the whole ensemble is when you have this. And you see that for those slowly rotating stars, it's not that they're always slowly rotating, but that they start out rapidly rotating and spin down as a function of time. And that spin down goes as the square root of the age, that the period increases as square root of the age. This is from 1972, the Szymanek result, and this is the basis for the idea that there is a relationship between the surface rotation period of a star and the age of the star. So, what exactly is any theory that we're going to use to describe this has to be able to reproduce these two things. So, what's going on here? We think what's happening is that this is the interplay of convection and magnetism in stars. So if you look at a one solar mass star, this thing is born rapidly rotating. When we look at young open clusters, we see that things are spinning fast, a day to 10 days. And this one solar mass star has a deep convective envelope. And that convective envelope is turbulent and churning. And the thing is also spinning. And those two features together help you to drive a magnetic field. So a star has a magnetic field. It's largely dipole, in at least at large scales. And there's some small amount of mass loss. The mass loss is ionized. It travels out along field lines. And it's forced to co-rotate with the star out to several stellar radii. In the case of the Sun, I think it's, the models say it's something like 7 solar radii. And so when this mass moves out, carries lots of angular momentum, then is lost from the system. And this turns out to be an efficient way, even with the low mass loss rates that we have for stars like the Sun, of losing angular momentum. So you start off rapidly rotating, you spin down pretty quickly, you spend the majority of your main sequence lifetime, which is the x-axis here, as a slow rotator, and you get the feature in the low mass star feature in the first diagram that I showed you. Now in these models, as you hit the main sequence turnoff, something else begins to happen. You now begin to physically expand substantially as you move across the subgiant branch. And so even if you were conserving angular momentum, you'd expect that your rotation period would drop, and the braking is still going on. And so that's what causes this steep downturn, decrease in the rotation rate, increase in the rotation period. Now, a 1.6 LMS star, in comparison, has thin or no convective envelope. And so presumably it's not driving a magnetic field. It doesn't have this sink for angular momentum, and so it's born rapidly rotating and just sits there and spins on the main sequence. Has some mild adjustments to the rotation period because as it evolves, its moment of inertia changes, but by and large, it conserves angular momentum. So this is the fast side of that first diagram, the rapid rotation. Now, as this guy hits the end of the subgiant, end of the main sequence, rather, and starts to evolve onto the subgiant branch, it too undergoes this physical expansion. But now, as you move across the subgiant branch, you're moving to cooler effective temperatures for your stars. And you can think of effective temperature as setting the depth of a convection zone in any star. And so as you move across the subgiant branch, these stars that had no convection zones develop them. And so presumably, at least we've modeled it this way, magnetic braking turns on. And so now you have both braking, and you've hit this, you're spinning quite fast, so the braking is quite strong. And you've got this expansion. So that's what this sharp downturn here is. So that's the picture for two stars. You can take a bunch of them and string them together and make a
So that last plot, this assumes rigid rotation with magnetic braking.
Yeah. Which is fine for the solar mass star, probably. You might argue with me about the 1.6 LMS star. Probably fine on the main sequence. Basically, that assumption is going to break down over here for both of these cases. And how badly it breaks is an open question, I think. So you can string a bunch of these together and make a rotational HR diagram. So this is not luminosity, but log G, so it's the same sense of it. Individual mass tracks are plotted here, and the color tells you the rotation period. So red is periods of about a day. The darkest blue is periods of 100 days. And you can see that we have two orders of magnitude of difference in the rotation periods on this plot. So there is a lot of structure. You expect a lot of structure here. This is the main sequence band here. You see the sharp transition from slow rotators that have braking to those that have no convection zones and don't. And then this is the subgiant branch up here. And you see that this break, which I refer to as the Kraft break at various points, persists well onto the subgiant branch. So while I'm going to be talking mostly about rotation as an age diagnostic, because that's kind of the thing most of you in this room, I think, would like to know and like to get out of this, here it's also a mass diagnostic. Because if you look at a fixed temperature on the subgiant branch, if you just take a slice, the lower mass things are slowly rotating, and the high mass things are rapidly rotating. And so you can imagine if you're somebody who looks at planets, and you're interested in the rate of planets around very massive stars, like very massive being 1.5 solar masses, where there's a lot of argument, you might be able to select those stars based on rotation rate if you know where to look. So it's another diagnostic tool that rotation can give you.
Yeah. It's the same thing, rigid rotation with braking.
Yes. And this diagram, so you have to pick where you start for the rotation. And the initial conditions matter almost not at all over here, and they matter a ton over here, because here you break and you end up not caring about them, and here you don't. So if I change the initial conditions on this diagram, it can go to the point where basically this whole side becomes green instead of red, if I choose the slower side of it. So it's actually a bit more complicated than I've made it seem. But you know, you can play with it and make your best guess about the diagnostic power of it.
But if if you just had imaging, so you just had, and not as precise imaging as something like Kepler, but if you just had, you know, some type of like LSST-like images, you could have rotation rates in principle, and you could have temperatures in principle. But the issue is that this is double valued.
Yes, exactly.
And
especially
so how do you, is there a clever way photometrically to break the degeneracy?
If you have X-ling photometry, like do you have like Kepler type photometry on these things?
Like ground based.
Yeah. So if you had Kepler like photometry, you could get a log G from the flicker.
Right.
That would be a way to do it.
But then you wouldn't, you know, right?
Yeah, you're still going to be, if you can't get a log G that's precise enough to tell the difference between these two branches, you're going to have a hard time.
Okay.
Unless, of course, you're looking at something like one of these stars, we see a very long rotation period, they show up, you know, unless you're in a place where you're not double valued, obviously.
Right.
But yeah, it's a problem.
Okay.
So actually, that's what this, thank you for leading me to my next plot. This is another way of looking at that same diagram, where now the colors of the lines here are different mass ranges. So this is 1.5 and above. The blue is 1.1 to 1.5 and 1.1 and below. And dotted lines are on the main sequence and solid lines are on the subgiant branch. So, you know, an individual star will trace a track like this. And you can see that if you look in particular at the 10 to 40 day period range, and that's kind of where we think gyrochronology will work, you know, you have for the low mass stars, this beautiful relationship between period and age, which is great, that's what we want. But you also have all these subgiants that are flying through this period regime simply because, you know, they were born hotter or more rapidly rotating and only now they're evolving through it. And like you said, it's double valued, and if you don't have log G information and you just go and you take a period and try to infer an age, you're wrong like a third of the time because the subgiants, you're biased towards detecting them in magnitude limited survey. So if you do like a galaxy model and you calculate this number, it's actually quite bad.
Just because they're the magnitude.
Yeah, because there's a lot of them with the magnitude limit. So that's the picture. But then again, you know, if you're seeing something that's got very long rotation periods, you're pretty safe to say it's a subgiant, which is nice. So there are kind of three regimes. There's cool main sequence stars that spin down, hot stars that don't, and then the subgiant branch, which is a mix of everything, and lots of complicated patterns depending on where you launched from here. So we can say, well, this is a nice picture, but can we test it with data now that we have a handful of stars from Kepler that we really know who they are, what they're doing, and what their ages and rotation periods are? So this is a very special 300-star sample that Rafa introduced to you last week. These are all stars that have astrocytes homology, so you know their ages. We know their evolutionary states very well. Their ages are somewhat more uncertain. We know their masses, and we have rotation periods for all of them. And what I've plotted here is just the period age diagram for all of these stars. And these two curves represent the literature relationships between period and age. And these literature relationships have a mass dependence in them. So basically, if you're following these relationships, if we believe that they're right, you should fall somewhere between these two curves. And what you see when you look at this is these stars are not falling between these two curves. You know, the sun, as it should, sits between them, and you have some, but you have a bunch of things that are far too rapidly rotating for their age out here, and things that are way too slowly rotating and yet young. But because we know who these stars are because of Kepler, we can color code them in the same way to give you an idea of who they are. So the hot stars now are in this blue-purple color. You can see that there basically is no relationship at all between period and age for these stars, just as we expected. The red stars are the dwarfs. They do tend to fall in between these two curves, more or less. Remember, the age uncertainties are actually quite substantial here. And the subgiants are doing their strange mixture of things. You have a couple of them that are very rapidly rotating because they're hot stars that have just started to move across the subgiant branch. And you have a few that are very slowly rotating because they've hit the base of the giant branch and they're now got periods close to 100 days. So all in all, this picture kind of hangs together. This is the trends that we expected to see, so this is nice. So we can go back to this and ask, what mixture of stars are we actually seeing in this diagram? And I think one of the nicest ways to answer this question is to do it as a forward modeling exercise rather than backing it out. So we can take a galaxy model of the Milky Way, which gives us a bunch of masses and ages and metallicities. And I can use those masses, ages, and metallicities to get a period from my own rotational models. And what I'm showing you here is just to remind you where you're kind of drawing things from. This is the selection that was done in the observational diagram that I showed you. So it's cut at 6,500 degrees. There's a log G TEF cut to remove the giants. But you get these kinds of stars. And here, the blue are, again, the hot stars, things that are born above 6,250 degrees. They may not be 6,250 today, but that's where they started. Subgiants and the cool main sequence stars. And so if you push this model forward and you make some assumptions about the detectability of rotation periods in this sample, which actually turns out to be important, you can get a diagram that looks kind of like what you see from the McQuillan sample. But because this is a model, we now know exactly what all of these stars are, and we can color code them. So the red, again, are the dwarfs. The subgiants are occupying this spray here. They have a range of different values. And the hot stars are just peeking in, even though they made a cut to try to remove these hot stars. So you do have a mixture here, and there are places where just picking out a single star is kind of a dangerous thing to do if you don't have information. Another interesting way of looking at this diagram is to ask which stars in this sample have undergone substantial angular momentum loss over the course of their lifetimes. And we can color code it like this to show that, where the red are stars that have basically not undergone substantial loss, and the black are stars that have. But again, I've just shown you that these are subgiants, and so these are stars that we don't really want to do gyrochronology on, so they are actually out as well. And so the area in which you can actually pick out stars in this diagram where you can use the relationship between period and age as a diagnostic kind of live here. And I'll explain why these edges occur, this edge in particular, in a little bit. All right, so how useful, let's say we've been assuming that gyrochronology works up to this point, but how useful is it really to measure rotation periods and try to get ages with it? So to do this, we're going to focus in, we're going to forget about the hot stars for a moment, forget about the subgiants, and focus in just on these cool dwarfs. And it turns out the picture there is more complicated again. So if you look at the very youngest open clusters, this is the ONC, Orion Nebula Cluster, you see that there is tons of scatter in the rotation period. There's basically, you know, an order of magnitude you've got in rotation rates here, and there's basically no trend with mass. Now, at and around this time period in open clusters, lots of stuff is happening. So you collapse out of your natal cloud, fine. That natal cloud may have some different amount of angular momentum that it gives to you at birth. So you already have scatter. However, if you look at these stars, they're not rotating at breakup, as you would have expected from a thing that just collapses down. They're actually rotating way too slow. And so we think what's happening is they're magnetically locking to their protostellar disks, and this locking allows them to shed angular momentum. So you lock to your disk, and that disk lives for a million years or 10 million years, and why and where that lifetime comes from is not entirely certain, whether it has a mass dependence or dependence on whether you have planets, etc. At some point, you are released from your disk. You usually haven't finished your contraction by that point. So when you're released, the disk disappears, you continue to contract and speed up. And we know that stars that are released earlier from their disks are more rapidly rotating, and those that are released later are more slowly rotating. Now, if you look at stars in this period of their evolution, they again don't do what you expect, because they're now more rapidly rotating than you would have expected them to be, based on their previous rotation. And this is because the core and the envelope of the star have decoupled. So you're contracting, your core and envelope decouple as far as angular momentum is concerned. Your envelope spins down, your core is rotating rapidly, a coupling time scale elapses, they come back into contact, and now you have more angular momentum available to you than it looked like you did. And so you're too rapidly rotating. And all of this happens basically before you arrive on the main sequence. And it's a mess, and it's complicated. And all of these things have mass dependencies and some stochastic element to them. So you could be really worried that you have no information at all in rotation periods. However, if you go now to 2.5 billion years, all of a sudden you have this really clear sequence. Go ahead.
Sorry, just before you move on. You have a statement saying that the longer you are locked to your disk, the more you spin down. Is that a theoretical statement, or it sounded observational?
It's observational. It's actually, so if you look at clusters, if you look at stars in a given open cluster, mm-hmm. and you detect infrared excesses around them, the ones that have no excess are more rapid rotators than the ones that have an excess. Yeah. And it, theoretically, that's what you'd expect as well, but it's observationally backed up in the Orion Nebula cluster, actually, it's one of the places. So by the time you hit 2.5 gigayears, now you have a really nice tight relationship between mass and period. There isn't a lot of scatter for these stars, and you can imagine that, you know, all that stochasticity and randomness that happened to you early on seems to be forgotten. So what's going on here? So I'm going to show you an animation from Courtney Epstein that I think does a beautiful job of kind of demonstrating how this works. So we have this magnetic breaking that's occurring. Magnetic breaking is a very strong function of your rotational velocity, which means that you can be born with a wide range of initial conditions, and if you're on the fast side of those initial conditions, you spin down very fast, and if you're on the slow side, you kind of linger and spin down very slowly. And so what this ends up doing, this strong exponent to the breaking law, forces convergence at late times, while bringing everything to longer rotation periods. So I'm going to play this animation, which is the... So what you're seeing in this panel here is the cluster M37. This is actual data, rotation as a function, rotation period as a function of mass. And what Courtney has done is she has applied a magnetic breaking law to these sets, this set of initial conditions, and let the cluster evolve forward in time using models. So this is data, but everything later in the animation will be a model. So I'll let it go. And you see that as a function of time, the entire converged sequence here shifts down. So you have a relationship between period and age. And you get a tight convergence along the sequence that gets tighter and tighter the older you are. So this is good. It's not often in stars that if you wait till something is older, you actually do better, right? Usually it's harder to tell anything about them. The reason that you're seeing that some of these stars appear to converge faster and that these guys are going slowly is because, again, it's when you look at it in detail, there's a complication. The breaking law saturates around here. And what that means is that as you become more and more rapidly rotating, your breaking doesn't scale accordingly. You have a break in the power law, basically. And so that's what you're seeing there. And that happens for the lowest mass stars. But basically, you end up with a tight sequence where if you have a particular mass and a particular age, there is one period that you expect to see with very little scatter. And that's an excellent situation to be in if you want gyrochronology to work. And in fact, if you do the calculation and you ask, how well can I do with rotation-based ages, it's actually, the answer is strikingly well. So this is the rotation mass age relationship curve that Courtney calculated. Now this assumes that the theoretical breaking law she used was correct, which may or may not be true. But you have in comparison, this is for a 5-gigayear-old star at any range of masses here. In comparison, you have astroseismology, which does well, but it cares about the fraction. It basically gives you a fixed precision of the main sequence lifetime. So for low-mass stars, your uncertainty in absolute time actually becomes quite large. And interestingly enough, this diagram shows you that this is a case in which Gaia actually doesn't solve your problem, because these are both the age precisions you'd get by localizing a star in an HR diagram with effective temperature and luminosity. And she's assumed here that you can measure the luminosity, effective temperature, and helium, good luck measuring helium, perfectly, and that it's only metallicity errors that are giving you uncertainty in your position. Even then, for a star, the lower mass stars, you really do quite poorly in your age precision. For the sun, you change something like 200 degrees, and your luminosity changes by a factor of 2 over 10 billion years. So it's a tough problem. So rotation-based ages have the potential to be incredibly useful, and they're relatively easy to measure. I should say, maybe not easy, straightforward, not easy. So what do you do to build a gyrochronology relationship? So the idea is that it's very hard to calibrate this from first principles. It's hard to figure out how strong the magnetic field is. It's hard to figure out how strong the breaking is. It's much easier to go out and measure a bunch of stars where you're lucky enough that you can get an independent age because they're in an open cluster or a similar type system. And you can get a rotation period. And then you just calibrate it empirically. And so you take some kind of power law relationship that relates here. They're using color as a proxy for mass, period, and time. And the idea is that all stars then should live on this kind of plane in this three-dimensional space. And open clusters trace out lines on this plane at fixed age and many different masses, and that if you can get enough lines and enough points, you can calibrate the curvature of this plane and you're good to go. Now, the thing that might bother if you look at this more closely is that The oldest open cluster we have period information for is 2.5 gig years old. The only calibrating point in most of these relationships at ages like that of the Sun is the Sun. There's no mass dependence, there's no metallicity dependence, and there is no information about stars older than the Sun. It's basically not anchored. And so this is a place where astroseismology is the perfect tool to test this kind of a technique, because astroseismology will give you points that live in this region of the diagram. You have a limited mass range that we're actually picking up with seismology, both because low-mass stars are hard to detect because the amplitudes are very low, and high-mass stars, you're pushing into that regime where you don't spin down anymore. So you have kind of a narrow color range, but you have quite, you're basically sensitive across many different ages. So you can pick up stars that are older than the Sun and figure out whether this extrapolation is actually working or not. So we can do that. We have a sample of about, I think this is about 20 stars here, that have exceptionally well-measured astroseismic ages. These guys have been individually modeled. You know, the individual frequencies have been modeled carefully on supercomputers by people in this room. There is no astroseismic age that is not model dependent.
That's right, but with the model, what is the model in the political stars in particular? This is like kind of trying to measure the size of the core or something like that?
So this is the whole frequency spectrum pattern changes slightly as the star evolves, so you get some structural information there. And the spacing, the small frequency spacing is sensitive to the sound speed gradient in the core, which is sensitive to the amount. So the uncertainties usually go as a fixed fraction of the main sequence lifetime for these stars. It's when you do it carefully like this. And you can see, so here the general trend, this is the period goes as the square root of age law that was first published in 1972. You can see these things generally follow the same kind of power law that you would have expected. You have stars older than the Sun that are kind of in the regime where you think they should be. There's also some interesting things, you know, you do have some stars that are showing up older than the Sun and more rapidly rotating than the Sun, which is a surprise. And this is something that I'm actively looking at now. Other people have been actively looking at it as well. This is a paper by Ruth Angus where she looked. This is basically the same sample of stars with the addition of a couple of field binaries here. And you know, she's been trying to model, she's been using the same kind of relationship that everybody has been using in the literature before. And she's finding, you know, that the cluster and the seismic data don't exactly play nicely with each other. The seismic points prefer kind of a underpopulated area of the posterior of these things. So there's some tension there. It's not clear exactly where it's coming from. It could be problems in the age scales of the clusters, problems in the age scales of the seismology, problems in the breaking laws, problems in the form of the breaking law that has no information about metallicity in it. There's lots of places where you could poke holes in what we already have and make it better. And I can comment tomorrow offline about what I think is going on here, but I'm not going to do it here on video. Do I have a question?
Well, you can tell me if you'll tell me tomorrow.
I'll tell you tomorrow.
On the previous slide, do the outliers, do their properties correlate with anything like metallicity or anything like that? Are they just total?
Let me tell you tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's kind of the picture here, is that we have now stars to calibrate this on the slowly rotating side, the old side, but it's not quite as clear-cut as we had hoped it was. However, we can also look at some other interesting stuff. The way that Kepler ended up working is the astroseismologists had their seismic targets first, and the planet people had their planet targets, and only the astroseismologist who, like, promised not to talk to anybody got to model the KOIs. And so it's only very recently that we kind of have information about the KOIs that, you know, the embargo has been lifted and we can now look at them. So these black points are the points that you saw in the last diagram, or the next last, and the blue points are the KOIs. And if you just look at this quickly, you might think, well, wow, the KOIs look very different from these stars. They're offset down off of here, and maybe the slope is different. And what if, you know, is this something that has to do with the fact that these stars have planets, or is there something else here? So if you look into the models, you figure out that this actually has nothing to do with planets at all, and it's just a difference in the masses of these stars. So the KOI sample is slightly biased towards higher masses, and the sense of a bias towards higher masses would be to shift this whole sequence in this direction here. These guys up here, when you start to evolve off of the main sequence, your tracks go like, you evolve like this, and then your tracks turn up. And so both of these things together tell you that it's not actually planets influencing your stars that you're seeing, it's just the mass. These are completely consistent with just having a shift in the mean mass of the samples. But it's another interesting place, and I'm happy about it, because it means that this is a whole another set of calibrators that we can use for the gyrochronology work, without having to worry that the planets have influenced them too much. So I'm going to wrap this up with kind of...
Make just a comment. It's also that we do not know if the dark points have or not planets.
That's true. So, right, I mean...
Which is good, so everything can be used without any worries about
the planets. Right, so these guys here, their planets are usually Earth-sized. So they're, if you look at it, you wouldn't have expected them to do anything to the rotation periods of their stars. And evidence from Kepler is that basically all stars have Earth-sized planets. And so, you know, that you detected them is a lucky trick of geometry and not much else. So I'm going to leave you with kind of a takeaway plot, which this is not actually plotted with data. This is my kind of sense of where this is going and how this is going to go. So I might be wrong, but I think this is an interesting way to view using gyrochronology. So this is the region of the mass age diagram that main sequence stars occupy. So this is the turnoff here. Now, I talked early on about the hot stars that don't spin down as a function of time. And so you're out if you look at masses above. It's going to be something like 1.4, give or take a little bit with metallicity. It's temperature that really matters, some combination of mass and metallicity that gets your particular temperature. For the very lowest mass stars, when we saw, if you remember Courtney's diagram, how they took the longest to converge, that makes it very difficult if they're not converged to get a good precise age. So for the very lowest mass stars, things below about 0.6 solar masses, you have a rough time. So they're pretty much out. For the very youngest stars, you have lingering sensitivity to initial conditions. That scatter that you started out with, you retain for a long time, and that's worse the lower mass you go. So you kind of lose, it's about a half a giga year up here, and then it gets worse as a function of time. Actually, this curve might be a little too aggressive. Maybe it's a little bit shallower. And then finally, I've talked about the fact that there are selection biases when you go and you detect periods. The fact of the matter is, old stars are very quiet. It's very hard to see them. When we look in the Kepler data, we don't detect rotation periods for many stars older than the Sun, based on their colors. So it's that. And we've also seen that there's some funniness going on for the very oldest stars in the gyrochronology relationships. And so regardless of which of these is actually ruling the problem, it may be the case that the oldest systems are also not the ones that you want to target with gyrochronology, which leaves you with a certain region in which you're probably good to go. And it looks like for, you know, kind of things that are solar-ish mass and only a few giga years old, gyrochronology will actually work very well and may be the best way of getting ages for stars. But there are definite limits to the applicability of the gyrochronology relationships. So, takeaways. Rotation is a very strong function of mass and age and evolutionary state. This is useful for us. Gyrochronology has potential to be a very powerful age indicator, but has a limited regime of applicability, and you have to respect that if you're going to use it or trust the ages from gyrochronology. And we're still kind of in desperate need of calibrators, and we're still trying to understand the calibrators that we have in the context of the ever-increasing pool of ages that we've got. So stay tuned, and we'll have more soon. Thanks.
I was wondering about this future. How far can we push this in the next couple of years with new data? Where is it going?
Yeah, so I think the next couple of years it's going to be rough, actually, because we've been relying, before Kepler, we had maybe less than 1,000 rotation periods. Kepler increased that, but it worked with Kepler because of the precision that Kepler has. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that if you don't have very good precision, you're basically, the younger you are, the more spotted and active you are, so the easier it is to detect you, and your rotation period is short too, so it's easier to detect that. So if you sacrifice in precision, you sacrifice in your ability to get the older things. And if you sacrifice in the duration of your data, you sacrifice also in your ability to get the oldest things. So the reality is, with something like TESS, which is going to be, you know, the near future for this kind of thing, their baselines are something like a month, which is not really good enough for a solar-like star. So you'd really, if you're looking in the continuous viewing zones, you're better, and you have enough time to get a couple of rotation periods in there. But you're going to have a hard time doing gyrochronology on kind of the bulk of the stars that you'd like to do it for. Plato, I believe, will be much better for this, but that's a little bit further in the future. If you want to do this for old solar-ish or slightly younger than solar stars, you really need the precision, something comparable to Kepler, to do it.
And how far out can you probe these
things? Boy, I don't know the answer to that. Basically, as long as you can detect a rotation. So, as long as you can detect a rotation period, so I would imagine it's going to fall. You'll be able to see younger things further away because they're going to be more variable. Mm-hmm. But I actually haven't thought much about that at all. So, they're all dwarfs, so you're already constrained to be fairly local, I guess. But
yeah. Which are the best calibrators? Obviously, open clusters or clusters are calibrators, but how can you get an absolute calibrator of any kind, except for the sun?
Yeah, so that I was actually thinking about that one day walking home from the program when I was here earlier. And we just, everything is tied to the cluster age scale across the board. I mean, except for the sun. And if you were able to get do the radioactive dating of some stars. That's not applicable for young stars. And even when you can do it, I think the uncertainties are they're large. That I think fundamentally we're going to end up tied to the cluster age scale, because all of our stellar models are tied to the cluster age scale. We test them on clusters. So, and the astroseismic ages you're not going to win because they're tied to the clusters already. So,
well, those are not absolute ages,
right?
Anyway.
And they're not absolute. Yeah. So, yeah, there's nothing.
But relative ages you can get.
Yeah. Right. There's just not much about a star that cares about absolute time. It's just the nature. You know, if you drop a star with a given composition and a given mass, it'll do what that star does regardless of how old that material is.
And what is the best application of this? Is that exoplanets or?
So I think it'll be really interesting for exoplanets as long as you're careful about the planets that you look at, because you do start to worry that there's been some difference in the rotational history between these two samples. It's, you know, we show that it's probably not going on in the ones that we looked at, but it's not necessarily the case across the board. So I think that's a really interesting place, and a place where ages could get you a lot of leverage to say something about how exoplanetary systems evolve as a function of time and over long time scales. I also think that it's one of the age indicators that you can point at a large section of sky, measure rotation periods for a lot of things, and get an age for a population. And it's hard with any of the other methods to do this. Astroseismology, it's right now it's too hard and too intensive for each star to do it. This is a way to get very good ages relatively quickly for a large sample of stars. So if you want to do population studies locally, I think it's a really good tool, provided you're not interested in only the 8. You know, if you're interested in 8-giga-year-old stars, I don't think it's going to work that well.
So gyrochronology had kind of a bad rap for a long time. And do you think that's because that people just were mixing together all these different populations and therefore wiping out all of the sort of trends that you showed? You show that, you know, there's a lot of part of parameter space where there would be dragons. And so is the reason for the bad rap that people were just mixing all these things together? Or has there actually been a real, you know, with Kepler, sort of realizations of new things?
I suspect, although I came into this a little bit, I came into it with Kepler, so I might have a different view on it, but I suspect it's got a bad rap because rotation is so complicated. There are so many things that matter. And when you're doing gyrochronology, you're making the assumption that you truly do forget about your initial conditions. That's a scary assumption, basically hasn't been tested. You're making the assumption that all stars have the same magnetic field morphology, because morphology, magnetic field morphology will change your breaking. It changes the breaking of the sun by an estimated factor of 4 over the course of the solar cycle. Like, scary stuff like that. There's lots of scary things in gyrochronology. And, you know, you can make a plot that says, look, there's a relationship between period and age, but look, digging deeply into that plot is a scary task. There's lots of uncertainties in all of the pieces that go in there. And so I think that's probably why it has a bad rap. It's because how can you tell that this is really as good as you think it is if you don't understand the underlying physics as well as you really should?
Is there anything that you could hope for in the data that would let you...
Yeah, so I think having a wide range of ages to test it is a great thing. Astroseismology, while it doesn't work for getting ages of broad samples, is an excellent tool for studying individual stars. And so it's the first time we've been able to get interior rotation profiles of stars, and this is a major stumbling block for the study of rotation, because we just don't understand internal angular momentum transport that well. And there's been lots of theories and lots of work, but basically they haven't been constrained because the only star you had any information on was the sun. And so with the addition of information from Kepler, you have an opportunity to really improve the underlying theory, which will feed back into the whole process.
Are there any more questions?
So, you know, I don't know. On what sort of timescale do you think there'd be 15,000 ages from gyrochronology from Kepler that you're like, I'd feel I'd be surprised if the relative ranking of these were drastically different?
I could see that happening on years timescale. It's particularly for the younger things, I could see it happening relatively quickly, especially the relative ranking. There's always going to be outliers for these things. You know, binary evolution and stuff like that is another thing I didn't even talk about, but that can mess up your distribution as well. But I think if you're taking a large sample like this, I think we're almost there. I would almost believe the relationships now for the things that are kind of 2-ish gigayears old. I think things are looking very good there. Older than that, I don't trust yet, but I think it basically works for, you know, solar-like stars at a few gigayears. I think we're okay. The precision, we could argue about. I don't know how the precision is going to be a question that takes a little bit longer to answer, but I think the rank ordering is probably fairly good already.
Can you calibrate to metallicity?
So nobody has done that exercise yet, and I think that it's certainly metallicity dependent, because the metallicity will change the depth of your convection zone. It's the depth of your convection zone that really matters for these things. So I think it's in there. Nobody's actually done the calibration. When we look at the seismic sample, we're dealing with a bunch of different metallicities. And part of the work I've been doing recently is trying to figure out, given the ages and the periods and the masses and the metallicities, does what we see make sense? And I think the answer is, it's interestingly discrepant still, even when you start to take that into account. But the metallicity calibration needs to be done and hasn't been done.
How metal poor do you run?
I think the most metal poor star is minus 0.4 is kind of the sample. They're mostly on the more metal-rich side.
So you mentioned Kepler and you mentioned TESS. What about K2? Does that buy you... What is K2 going to do for both rotation and astroseismology?
Rafa, what's K? Are we going to get rotation periods for K2?
So yeah, for the sample of stars that Jen has been talking about, so it's 80 days per field. So we have had a first sample of 20 solar-like stars, and I can tell that at least for two of them we have beautiful rotation periods. So that says yes, we can obtain rotation periods in the solar-like stars around solar values. So yeah. And also the other thing that K2 can provide something is that K2 will see some clusters. So we can do detailed astroseismology on the stars on those clusters. We have the hope of doing that. So also we will have in that case the information of the cluster ages and rotation, but also for what we obtain from the time modeling of a few handful of stars. So that's also a new way to go. So definitely K2 is very important. And then you will have Kleypers, you have clusters in the fields, and you will have a Kepler, but with clusters and everything else. That will be the next big thing to do.
Can you go back to the eel?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh. We'll have to do this in a different way.
What is that? What was it? Zion? Is that Zion?
Yeah, Zion.
Yeah, Zion.
So is the mouth real? Like, is that, is that a real thing? And so you showed us how the spray, you showed us the spray of the subgiants and the hot stars and the dwarfs, but what's the mouth?
Yeah, so there's no theoretical reason that we know of why that should be there. I have spent more days than I'd like to admit trying to model it as a blending effect, where you take a star that's slightly hotter and blend it with an M-dwarf, and the M-dwarf's so much more valuable that you detect the period of the M-dwarf, but the stellar properties of the hotter star. Been trying to, because there's some, if you look at the period amplitude plots, it's bibonal there too, and it's weird. It looks very much like a blended population, but no matter what I do, I can't seem to get it to look just like that. You could argue, you could say, well, maybe M-dwarfs have some kind of weird rotational evolution where they go slowly through here and quickly through here and then slowly again. That's not very nice, and none of the detailed information. Yeah, and nothing we have the detailed information says is that there's any kind of morphological reason why, any kind of reason why that should happen. The argument that the people, that Amy McQuillan and company made for this paper was that the bimodality is actually an age effect. An age effect would give you, if you had a burst of star formation here and nothing and then another one, you would get, it's easy to get bimodality. If you mess, I can mess with the ages in my galaxy model and I can get you something that looks like this. But I have to do some pretty uncomfortable things to it. Just, you gotta lose a chunk out of there. You basically gotta turn star from, and why you see it here and not here, these stars are kind of the same age as these stars as well.
What are the age?
I think this is roughly 1 gig-year. This is roughly 4-ish up here. So it's a weird, you're not seeing anything very, very old here. I don't think it's a selection effect. When they look at it in proper motions, they also see that there's a proper motion, slight difference in the proper motions between the two populations. The sense that
this
the older one is.
What if you had a satellite in there?
What if you have a satellite?
What if you had debris? What if there's a huge stream in the Kepler field?
That is a really good point. That's a really good point. I will look at that, because if you don't plot this in log, like it is here, it's a really narrow. That's a really good point. I will think about that. That's a good point.
Where's the Kepler field?
I don't remember the exact.
It's in the halo somewhere, right?
No.
It's popping out of it's out of the disk slowly.
Is it? Oh, I thought it was
6 years.
6 years. So it's
not even. It doesn't go that. Oh, what's the farthest star?
The farthest star in the Kepler field?
Yeah, well, in this sample.
In this sample, I don't think we know.
It's like
13
so it's still a local sample. What about spiral arms and things like that? Could be also
But you have to have it show up. It has to be something that's an 8. Like, age would do it.
That's what I'm saying. Okay. Yeah.
You expect. You would expect
that. That would pass through the star through an arm, or once the arm is
the latitude.
So you'd expect strong gradients in age in the spiral arms?
You're out of the disk. You're at latitude of 20 something.
But if you're still low,
get out of the disk. Not very hurried.
That's true.
Yes, most stars are in the disk, so most stars are pretty local. The farthest away is 2 kiloparsecs. Most of them are within, let's say, 300 parsecs. So it's a really thin disk. I think most of the stars are in the disk, but we might get them.
I mean, half the stars must be within.
I mean, they are bright stars. If they are that cool, they must be bright stars. I mean, local stars.
Yeah, no, no. This, especially this one, must be really a few hundred galaxies.
Yeah, so probably you sample a different distant population across as well, which might help with your why it's there and why it's not.
Yeah, you could do a distance cut.
I can't remember if they may have looked to see whether the two populations populated the Kepler field evenly. I cannot remember if they did that exercise or not, but that might be an interesting thing to look at as well for figuring out whether this is that kind of thing.
But if it's something, if it's like a coeval population, either from a spiral arm or from a cluster, it
isn't. So the galactic latitude is 5 to 22 degrees.
Oh. Wow. Okay.
But it's the mean distance, I think, that matters more, and those things must be within. But what's the limit? I mean, we should be able to use.
Well, this is Kepler magnitude of 16. I don't know what that is.
And most of the M's are above the magnitude.
So yeah, so
that's the way for an M dwarf, that might be 16.
It's above 16, but I think most of them are closer to 14.
Observationally speaking, those are very hard to be observed. They are very faint. I don't know if you remember my talk. There is a famous factor of 2, and it's exactly a factor of 2 between the two branching points.
Right, yeah, so that's another thing that they looked at. They, by eye, looked at all of these guys to see, because they were concerned about the fact that they are convinced it's not, but you still need to.
It was only done with the first 4 or 5 quarters, so all of these parts should be redone with all the full range of Kepler data.
But I think this is the full range for this paper. I think the first paper that pointed out the bimodality was only a few. No, I thought it was.
If you just looked at this plot, each of the different Kepler chips,
yeah.
What do you see? Do you know?
Yeah, that's I can't remember if they did that exercise or not, but yeah. I think it's a good one to do, and I will do it.
Has anyone done like I don't know, KDE on something to see what features? So I get the TF that are from selection effects, but you know, there's some interesting horizontal-ish bands. I can squint and tell myself that there are areas of low density. So you can almost think that the mouth continues down.
Yeah, it actually does.
Or
If you look in a histogram, it actually continues to about here. And actually, right around here, the Kepler pixels are very large, and it's very likely that you have lots of blending. And blending is going to kill you the worst right about here in shifting your stuff around in effective temperature and not in period. And kind of reordering things. So it very well could persist deeper into this mess, and you've blended it away there. So.
And when you look at those histograms, that's the only feature that you see?
I mean, you see these edges here, right? This this edge says that there's not many things younger than a gigayear that you're seeing, which is fine. This edge happens at about 4 gigayears, but I think it's a detection bias, not an actual age bias. Because it wouldn't make sense if there were age. But those two edges and the gap are the most substantial features that you see.
I mean, I maybe try to convince myself, but at 20 days, there's almost like a line across from 5,000 to 4,000. But maybe it's...
Oh, yeah.
Go to the right. Here? Go to the right, yeah. Like flat almost. Yeah.
Oh, this?
No. Yeah. No. But so you obviously really have to squint. Don't worry about it. This is a decent distance.
I don't know.
I'm squinting.
Remember, this is log too, so it looks a lot different when you unlog it too. Okay. Different stuff pops out at you. This is actually much tighter because log all that.
But how is the temperature determined in this diagram?
Yeah, so the temperature is not, the temperatures are not great. It's the Kepler input catalog.
Yeah, could also affect the whole thing, yeah.
It can move stuff
around. For example, at least the vertical stripes.
Right, and remember what Rafa said earlier too, when we were talking about determining rotation periods, there's the factor of two issue, and also this group has done a test on injection and recovery simulation, and I think they're only good. Only about 60% of the periods come back, 60 or 70 come back correct. So there's also, a large fraction of stars in here that probably mismeasured for whatever reason.
So we shouldn't be looking at this at all.
All right, this is two orders of magnitude more rotation.
As I said in my talk, I mean, I think the general picture is correct, but don't go into the details yet.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and I underline it yet.
All right.
I think that there are many things we have to check, temperatures,
period,
everything else, but the average picture, I think it's correct.
Sure.
And you know, that's why this bimodality is interesting to study, because it could like very well be just instrumental or an oops in many different ways. It could be a mistake. So,
all right, everybody, let's thank Jen again.